It's a great pleasure to welcome to this conversation Sid Chararia, private investor focused on wonderful businesses at wonderful prices in Asian markets, including India, China, Japan, Australia, and ASEAN. Asian markets are inefficient and less competitive relative to developed markets and provide a rich and growing fertile ground for global value investors. As I'm sure most of you will know, Sid has been a terrific contributor to the MOI Global community, both in terms of ideas as well as his wisdom and insights into value investing in Asia. I won't go too much into Sid's background, except to say that he even got the attention of Warren Buffett with a letter in which Sid informed Buffett of a 125-year-old wide moat Japanese company, and that prompted Buffett to encourage Sid to keep his eyes open for great businesses in Asia. So, Sid, I feel like we're a little bit in Buffett's shoes here because you've kept your eyes open for us as well. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So perhaps we could start with you describing your process and how you are spending your time.
Yeah, John, the Chinese have a saying, may we live in interesting times, John. And John, that certainly holds very, very true today. I've seen a few crises. I was an analyst at Merrill Lynch in 2008 when I thought the world was coming apart. I was just getting started as a 17-year-old in the 2000 financial crisis, and I thought the world was coming apart then. And, you know, we live certainly in interesting times. I just want to start off with a disclaimer. This is not advice. It's just meant for education and informational purposes only. Folks should consult their own advisors depending on their own requirements. This is my personal views only. As John mentioned, since March, I have the best job in the world, really. I'm managing my own personal capital. It's really the best kind. It's a long term. I don't have clients calling me and annoying me with annoying questions. So really what I'm thinking, you know, what I'm looking at is thinking long term, how to multiply my capital over the next 3, 5, 10 years, and over the next 3 decades, really. So my time, John, is being spent solely identifying and investing in a portfolio, my personal capital, Asia's wonderful businesses at wonderful prices and for the long term. This is really my goal, to accumulate one of the best records in Asia, which I think is a less competitive market, which I think I strongly believe it is the Asian century for the next 2, 3 decades. Simply put, I can describe my process as the following. The first is just identifying great businesses, like the one I sent to Mr. Buffett in 2013. What is a great business? It is a business that has a narrowly defined focus. It's a niche. It's a niche, like Kobayashi is. It has a reinvestment opportunity. A great business has a runway for growth. It is a cash cow, generates and throws off a lot of cash, and it has pricing power. You know, I would say MOI is a great business. It is a niche, has a long runway for growth, limited capital intensity, and has pricing power, John. So that's a wonderful business. The second thing I look for is incentives. Personally, I've gone through a number of life events which have taught me that incentives matter significantly. You know, so what I do is I look at a 15, 20-year track record of management. I scrutinize their capital intensity decisions. I scrutinize their reinvestment opportunity to reinvest capital or large amounts of capital. I'm not interested in small amounts of capital. I'm looking at their capital return policies. Were they buying back stock aggressively in the financial crisis? Not at highs. I'm looking at compensation structures, looking at the culture of a firm. Culture is extremely, extremely important. And you know, one can do very well focused on companies with terrific cultures that empower employees, incentivize them for the long term and keep them for the long term. And finally, accounting quality, accounting decisions. And the third step really is the wonderful price. What do I mean by wonderful price? It has to be a no-brainer, right? Like Kobayashi was, like my presentation on Nesco in 2013, no-brainer prizes. That's what you're really looking for. You don't need to make a lot of decisions. You just need to make a few great decisions. And I think that's what truly differentiates long-term records. So I like to pay single digits cash flow. You know, if I can, obviously there are other metrics. You look at balance sheets and try and adopt the Graham approach, overlaying the growth characteristics and reinvestment opportunities of the business. MOI, finally on this question, John, MOI members, you know, that are familiar with my presentations, particularly in 2013 and 14, the ones I made, like Kobayashi, the idea I sent to Warren Buffett, and Nesco, both ideas have multiplied four times since those presentations, and they've meaningfully beaten the indices, the global indices, including the NASDAQ, not just the Asian indices. But most importantly, they've done so with low downside risk. Both ideas were identified during a time when really they were no-brainers. So that describes my process, and that describes how I'm spending my time, you know, trying to find ideas that I could allocate my personal capital.
Great. Well, Sid, what is your assessment of the crisis and the sell-off?
Yeah, I think, John, firstly, the health, humanitarian, societal impacts, unemployment, obviously tragic. And there's that side, which I'm not going to go into. It's obviously impacting lives, you know, and is obviously tragic and sad. And I wish everyone, MOI members, you know, and their families, everyone safe. And, you know, that side of the story, it's obviously a crisis, a different one. Now, you know, my topic is about the markets and investing in the crisis. So, you know, I'd start off saying that a wise man once said, you know, only when the tide goes out, you know, who's been swimming naked. And really, this crisis in some ways has really tested many managers, right? It's really testing the investors. It's really testing the loyalties of investors who've invested in these managers. And it's testing processes, you know, people that, you know, have, you know, thought they know what they were doing. So it's really testing many folks. And really only when the tide goes out, you know, who's swimming naked, and it's still early days. One only needs to look at the defense Warren Buffett, Seth Klarman, legendary investors, were playing with cash positions leading into the crisis, and with hedges. Even Ackman, love him, hate him, you know, today, or I read a recent interview where he said he had about 18% cash, obviously aggressively deploying it as the markets have fallen significantly. What we witnessed, you know, it was mind-boggling, just some of the valuations in many of the markets. India, Southeast Asia were mind-boggling and certainly far from wonderful prices. And so while the crisis was not necessarily, was a catalyst to the sell-off, a lot of the names that have got hit were extremely overvalued. I mean, some good businesses at cheap prices have got hit, but not as much, and I'll go through it. So what we witnessed is severe selling in Asia. We witnessed currencies getting hit. This is something US dollar investors don't necessarily think about, just investing in US markets, but Asian currencies and emerging markets have got hit, and that's a critical part to the investing in a crisis. And then you witness different actions from different governments, right? Travel bans, stock exchange closures, closing economies, folks can't travel, I'm stuck. Just to give you an update on Asia so that we set the ground, you know, you look at India, you know, which is where I'm from. I was at a high of 41,000 odd, hit a low of 26,000. It was down about 38% in about 28, 29 trading days. It had its biggest ever fall, 4,000 points. a 13% decline in one single day. That was catastrophic. I mean, that type of selling is not being witnessed in India. You've had the FX weakened by about 7%. So the Indian rupee is at 76. So dollar investors are getting hit both on the equity as well as the FX. Now you have a lockdown of 1.3 billion people. That's four times the population of the United States, right? A lockdown for 21 days. Imagine the impact, in India, GDP per capita of 2,000, 2,500. So it's a poor country. So imagine the impact there to businesses, small, medium businesses. The 2007-08 peak to bottom was about minus 50, 57. It took, it was extended over late 07 to March 09. It was about 15 months. Nothing, not as fast as this particular sell-off, obviously early days. Even the quality names, which I said were very expensive, HDFCs down 30 plus percent, ICICI 40%, Bandhan Bank down 70%. You have future retails down 70-80%. I mean, the decimation is unbelievable. You don't believe the prices you're seeing. Now, there are stocks up even in this market, right? DMart, which is a very well-run retailer, is actually up. A bunch of the pharma companies, Ipca, Ajanta Pharma, they're up. But that's just 2-3% of the market. Now, moving to Japan, right? That market saw about 31% in about 30 trading days, approximately, give or take. There was a day it fell nearly 2,000 points. And that's the worst drop since April 1990. More than 95% of the Japanese market is down. The yen is down, about 2%. So it's actually done reasonably well relative to other Asia EM currencies. But the speed of the sell-off has significantly, obviously, compared to 2007-08, has been quite severe. Now, mind you, most of us have not been investing that long, but the Nikkei peaked at near 40,000 in 1989 and fell about 50% in 7 to 8 months by 1990. So the Nikkei has, back in when the bubble burst, witnessed significant sell-offs. Now, Japan's working on a stimulus. Now, stocks that are up, I hate to beat my market, my own, presentations, but Kobayashi is actually up this year. It's up about 10%. Pan Pacific Don, is up. And then you've got Chugai Pharmaceutical. So there are some good quality companies that are still up, and some of the better quality companies are down less than the index. Moving on to, and what I'm really trying to do is just give MOI members a sense of what's happened in Asia, because I understand the community is, somewhat, I mean, although lots of members in Asia, I'd like to just set the ground. Australia has witnessed probably one of the most ferocious sellings in Asia, down about 32% in about 23 trading days. ASX had its worst fall, just about a week or two ago, it was down 10% decline. 07 to 08, it had fallen from 6,800 to about 3,200 odd, but that took about 15 months. So the selling has been quite extreme in Australia. 15-20% declines have been quite normal. What is the severest part on the Australian sell-off is the currency. The currency is weakened by a mind-boggling 16%. Wow, that's really ugly. So you have just about 4% of stocks in that market that are up. High-quality names like CSL, which is a great company, a great business, that's still up. Now moving on to Hong Kong, this market has fared relatively better, I would say, than other Asian markets, down about mid-20s in about 47 trading days. But mind you, Hong Kong had its own crisis last year with what was going on with the protests and whatnot. But business it's tough times. I used to live previously in Hong Kong. It's a great city. Hong Kong tourism is on a free fall. It's down 96%. Hong Kong has, the government has given out a stimulus, you know, $1,200 to every resident there. You know, unemployment's at a 9-year high. You know, the FX there, at least, you know, it's pegged, so has done okay. Moving on to Korea, this market's now at a 11-year, or about a few days ago, about an 11-year low. The Korean won down 6% or so year to date. I mean, give or take, depending on the day, you pick about a 10-year low. You know, just about 4 to 5% of the stocks are up. You know, again, pharma, home entertainment. In 2007-08, the 50% decline was over a period of time, and the severity of the sell-off has been quite extreme. Moving on to South Asia, I'll just touch only on a few of the countries there. You know, Singapore down about 30% in about 34, 35 trading days. The Singapore dollar is, you know, at sort of 2009, 2015 type levels, 146. The first quarter GDP actually contracted about 2%. Which is the most decline since the financial crisis in 2008-09. Very few stocks are up, very, very few. It's probably 6 or 7. The SGX, the Singapore Exchange, is up. C, which is an internet business listed in the States, Southeast Asia internet business, is up. Many of the banks have got hammered. Singapore Airlines, one of the best airlines in the world, is at all-time lows. There's talks of Temasek support, obviously a fantastic company, but like other airlines, tourism, retail have got hit. Moving on to Indonesia, this market has been amongst the worst hit in Southeast Asia. You've had the rupiah at its lowest lows compared to 1998, the stock market from peak to low has fallen about 38% in 50 days. So you have the equity declines, and then you have the currency declines. So it's been amongst the worst hit. Now, mind you, this is a country that has 260 million people, and there are great businesses. They're essential to consumers that are now starting to look very, very interesting or attractive. And finally, in Southeast Asia, I would say Thailand. Now, Thailand, as you know, visitors from MOI know, it's well known for its tourism, healthcare, hospitality industries, and that has taken a severe hit. Thailand's been on somewhat of a free fall, down about 36% in about 45, 46 trading days. The baht, Thai baht's declined by about 10%. But still relatively stable. I mean, if you look at a long-term chart, just to mention a few names, the airports of Thailand is down minus 32% or so. This is one of the best airports assets in the world. Still a bit expensive, but a great asset to keep on the watch list. Home Pro is down about 35%. Minor International, another tourism name, is down 60%. Very few names are up. High quality Hypermart, not CM Macro, is up. So that's there you go, John. I think what I wanted to do was just set the stage in terms of what's happened in Asia with the equity markets. Obviously severe. At the same time, you know, obviously we've had this euphoric last 2-3 days of rallies, but you know, as an investor, these are not easy times to invest, right? What worries me long term is, you know, and if you I read Howard Mark's memo, which is a great read, the implications on unemployment, right? This is the reality, right? Like you saw the numbers today, supply chains, implications on healthcare. Travel and tourism form a huge part of GDP contribution. EM balance sheets, FX, they're very stretched. And the Fed's really throwing everything at it. This is really untested territory, you know. And so, and Warren Buffett said, negative interest rates, no one really knows how this will play out. And this is something that he hasn't necessarily also seen in his long investing career. And so there is a lot to be careful about. The last couple of days have been euphoric, but the reality on the ground, it does not reflect, the significant bounce, at least the last 3 days. So there you go, John. Yeah.
Great. Sid, what opportunities do you find for each of these Asian markets, if we can go through some specific company names?
Sure, John. John, firstly, what I would like to say, just before that, right, I'd like to say, how is it is, I think, a crisis is an opportunity, and it's a terrible crisis for those impacted. And that's sad. The first thing really is, to reiterate, high quality businesses. This is a time not to sacrifice that, right? Reinvestment rates, niches, runways for growth. One of the exercises I've been doing is stress testing balance sheets. And I ran a simple analysis just across the world. And really, I looked at how, if sales decline 30%, 50%, 100% for some businesses, which it has in March or April, for some businesses or many businesses, how many years of cash and investments do they have to actually pay off operating expenses, and make some assumption on that 30, 50, 100. And I actually came up with a very interesting list of businesses, some of which I'll talk about. Obviously, you really want to be very, very careful about balance sheets. That's very important. Off balance sheet liabilities as well. Leverage, very important in Asia. You want to really focus on companies that have maybe domestic borrowings and have bank lines, et cetera. You want to avoid the US dollar type debt. They've raised debt, but again, you got to be very careful about that. And covenants, you got to be careful about supply chains, which companies are most susceptible to supply chain shocks, and sort of their negotiation power and dependence and diversification of supply chains. That's really important investing in Asia. I would say customer concentration is actually way more important now. It's always been important, but very important now, because you want to also do research on the customer and just make sure that they're doing okay. How are their balance sheets? It's not just analyzing the parent co. Then you want to look at companies that have been paying dividends or repurchases through not cash flow, but borrowed money or raising money and paying out dividends. That game's going to stop at some point. So you want to be careful about those businesses. You want to also, in my view, avoid small caps. I'm not a big fan of small caps. I used to love hunting in these little small caps, but liquidity really, really disappears. And so you really want to be careful there. And finally, and want to be in great businesses with good capital allocation. So just because the price has dropped does not mean, it's a good buy. You want to pay attention to some of these points that I've mentioned. For some businesses, falling equity prices are actually a debt knell, because it's correlated to kind of their own negotiation power with their various ecosystems. So be very disciplined, have a list of great businesses, know those businesses really well, and know them well. Now, coming to your question, John, on what opportunities I find in Asia, and I'll just name a few at a high level, because you have the Asia Summit, and so there's an opportunity to do a deep dive there. But starting off with my home country, India. Now, India was a market, I must admit, over the last 3 years, a lot of people laugh at me because they're like, Sid, you don't understand India, wonderful business always at really crazy prices, like 70 times, 80 times, 60 times earnings. 60 is actually value investing in India. And so I found it very hard. So that's why I've always gravitated to Nesco and a few other, undiscovered small and mid caps. Now these great businesses have sold off significantly, and they're great businesses. They're not going away anywhere. HDFC, for example, that bank is down 40%. It's a bank that Warren Buffett, in my view, would buy if he could. It's a great bank, and it's fallen 40%. India is in a lockdown for 21 days. imagine the repercussions on the economy and just unemployment, et cetera. So I think investors should pay very close attention to India. It's going to throw up a lot of interesting opportunities. One name I'd like to discuss is ITC. It's a household brand in India. It's a leader in FMCG. They have FMCG packaging, hotels, IT. It's a 110-year-old business, ITC. The company reaches about 125 million households in India. So one out of every three Indians are reached by ITC. It has an unrivaled distribution network. It has an 18-year track record of growing revenue. It has an 18-year track record of EPS growth. And profits and operating cash flow and free cash flow, about 17 to 18 years. It has paid out 75% of its free cash flow in either dividends or repurchases. That's quite high compared to Indian standards. The returns on capital of the core businesses are around 40 to 50%. Now, this stock, for various reasons, now is trading at just 10 times earnings. 10 times earnings. Now, ITC, I'm not saying it's the perfect business, but ITC trades at just about 10 times my estimate. So it's a great business. It's been around 110 years. A second name that I was one of the first in the investing community to discover was Nesco back in 2013. I pitched it for the first time late 2013, early 2014, in Manual of Ideas. At the time, what I was attracted by was its land bank, right? It has a 70-acre piece of land that was worth more than the market cap at the time. And so it was a no-brainer because it had a reinvestment opportunity for 20 years. Obviously, the thesis has evolved over time, like most theses, but that was when no one followed it. Now, coming back to the stress test of balance sheets that I talked about just about 20 minutes ago, as I said, I ran a stress test on companies all over the world just to see how the balance sheets were. Nesco is the only company in India that comes up that if their sales go to zero, which is obviously an extreme scenario, it can still pay all its operating expenses for 7 to 8 years. So Nesco's business, whatever, you want to haircut the revenue, profits, this business is going to be around, it's going to be around for 10, 20, 30 years, unless the, and so the balance sheet. So that is one hell of a margin of safety. And, I would say, Nesco is very interesting. Moving on to Japan, obviously, this is a very interesting market. Lots of companies with cash piles. The private equity guys are raiding that market, or were raiding it, still are. Some examples there. Nintendo, it's a great company. This company has balance sheet full of, intellectual property. Cash is about 31 net cash and investments, 31% of the market cap. So even if Nintendo had no sales for, a couple of years, 3 or 4 years, it would still survive this crisis. Now, the game changer here for Nintendo is it has a partnership with the dominant Chinese internet company, which is Tencent. Tencent and Nintendo are partnered for Tencent to help with Nintendo's growth opportunity in China, which is the world's biggest. The Chinese are addicted. So I would say that reinvestment opportunity is significant for Nintendo over the next 10, 20 years. This is a 131-year-old business. It has 16 years of positive operating cash flow, 18 years of track record of profits. It has paid out 79% of its free cash flow in dividends or repurchases. And the stock trades at my estimates between 7 to 8% free cash flow yields. Not a no-brainer, but this is a great business, a great company. And if this were to fall, certainly would be on my watch list. Next name in Japan, Keyence. Keyence is a solid balance sheet. One of the slides that they show to their investors is that if sales, the company has the wherewithal to last for 17 years or 15, 16, whatever the number is. My own estimate is it's about 10 to 12 years. If sales went to zero, they could still pay all the operating expenses for, call it 10 to 17 years, if you believe the company in 17 years. Now, obviously, the question is, why are you holding the cash and how long are you going to hold the cash? But now, I wanted to highlight companies like Keyence, which are great companies with solid balance sheets. Stocks fallen, I would say low double digits. A stock that has got slammed in Japan that I like the business is Ryohin Kikaku or the Muji brand. Muji, it's a very well-known brand. Muji, obviously, it's a retailer. The stock's got slammed close to 60% this year. Now, it has a great track record. It has a 20-year track record of positive operating cash flow, positive net profits, 20-year track record of growing revenue, right? Growing revenue. It has a 15 to 16-year track record of growing EPS. This stock's down 55 to 60%. It's a good capital allocator as well. It's paid 53% of its free cash flow in dividends and repurchases, which is quite high in Japan. And it's trading, in my estimates, between 10 to 12 times earnings. And so this is a stock that has, slightly controversial, but it's got slammed and, quite interesting as China has reopened. Muji was really, quite impacted because of that shutdown there before, but China is starting to reopen. And I think Muji, if you take a 3-year horizon, which I am, and people should do their own work, that's very interesting. Moving on to Korea, John, a business that I think is a Charlie Munger, Lee Lu type business is Atogi. Atogi is a household brand in Korea. Literally, it touches, I would say, the lives of every South Korean. It is a household brand. This company has a 16-year track record of growing revenue, a 15-year track record of operating cash flow, 20-year track record of net profit, positive. As I said, I believe, it fits the Munger, Lee Lu type, wide moat business, because it really is synonymous with life in South Korea. And the business, it's not exceptional capital allocator. It's 35% free cash flow is being paid out in dividends or repurchases. But the stock trades for a great brand at 10 to 12 times earnings. So it's very hard to lose there unless they do some stupid capital allocation, which is possible. But I think the odds are starting to get quite interesting. Finally, just a few concluding remarks on some other markets. Indonesia, as I said, the market was down about mid-30s in a short amount of time. And the currency has got significantly hit at 1998 levels. Now you're starting to see wide moat businesses like Unilever Indonesia. Everyone's familiar with Unilever. Unilever Indonesia has also fallen, I don't know what it is as of today. I would say 25-30%. That's one stock that had defied gravity and so has started selling off and now is starting to look attractive. A long track record, I would say 20 plus year track record of, free cash flow positive, pays out a lot of its dividend, because of its parent, et cetera. So that's very interesting. And on the banks in Indonesia, I like Bank Mandiri, single digits earnings, good bank, good IR. I'm not a bank investor, but I think the odds are very good with Bank Mandiri. Finally, one of the most interesting markets, China. I won't go too much into this particular market here because I'll save it for future presentations on deep dives. But the internet, many of the internet businesses that are essential to, Chinese consumers, et cetera, are very interesting, especially in the education space, the human resource space. Many of these stocks have got hit and are cash cows. One of the company that I'd like to present in the future is a company that if, sales went to zero, it would still have the wherewithal to pay operating expenses for 7 to 8 years. So those are the types and trades at an 8 to 10% cash flow yield. So those are the types of opportunities I'm focused on. John, I'll leave it there.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing those names, Sid. What areas should investors avoid in those Asian markets?
Yeah, John, I think I touched on some of this shortly before, but the first thing is really know yourself, right? This is a treacherous market. Investing in a crisis, this is where experience does matter. I think it's good to have, you know, gone through a few crises, or at least one, at least 2008. I think many new investors, you know, maybe really taken aback by the speed and ferocity, and it will come to questioning your process. So first is know yourself, know your process, and really just make sure that you are getting your fundamentals correct, right? Because really, I've known investors who exited the game because, frankly, they weren't investing, it was speculation. And so in terms of what, and one way to do that is to avoid the types of businesses that I you know, I'm going to talk about, which are really, you really want to focus on companies with very strong balance sheets at this time, right? Like do haircuts on sales, you know, really think about what the operating cost structure is, fixed versus variable. Obviously, that's very important. And I've done that exercise. I think leverage in Asia really can kill you, especially for US dollar denominated. Imagine a company in Indonesia having dollar denominated debt and its currencies at 1998 lows. You know, its ability to finance or just its, so that's very important. And so just stay away from that. I focus on cash cows. Net cash balance sheets, there's plenty of those opportunities around. Why would you want to take a levered bet in this environment particularly? And then, you know, be very cautious about the supply chain, just the ecosystem, really. Who are its customers, customer concentration, what sort of leverage does it have, you know, on working capital, you know, look at the supply chain, you know, where are its factories, et cetera. You know, some of these Japanese companies are expanding in, you know, Vietnam, or just look at kind of where the supply chains are, because, you know, this is not just about the numbers you see on a financial statement. This is, you know, you want to think like an owner and you want to understand how the business would be run. In times of crises, in times of travel restrictions, in times of, you know, where your currencies. So I think you really want to, you know, and then you want to avoid those dividend, as I said, companies paying dividends just from borrowing, because that game might stop. So I think that's my advice, John. And, you know, I touched on it briefly before.
And Sid, maybe as we finish up, what would you say is your key takeaway for investors in this environment?
Well, I would say, you know, this is, you know, a crisis brings opportunity to, you know, not just for investing, but also for reinventing your own career and your own, you know, I've been through many personal crises and professional ones. And, you know, I think each time it was a great opportunity to reinvent myself and reinvent, you know, just, you know, myself and the process, et cetera, and just a lot of self-reflection. So I think this, you know, my first advice, especially to those young aspiring investors, which I assume there's not too many of them on MOI, but for those that haven't experienced, you know, really make sure you truly understand your process. You know, it's just so important, because otherwise you turn into a zombie investor at some point, because, you know, you thought you knew what you were doing. So really just really find a good mentor and just, you know, understand what your process is. You know, I'd like to end it with just reiterating my own goals, which are, my goal is to invest my personal capital, right? I don't manage any outside capital. Currently, I'm not averse to it. But, you know, I look for really three things: a great business. And that's easier said than done. There aren't that many great businesses, right? Otherwise, Warren Buffett wouldn't have been sitting on 130. So great business. And have that list ready and really work very hard to make sure you truly understand why this is a great business. The things I talked about, reinvestment opportunity, return ratios, cash generation, niches, market share, pricing versus volume, like just really understand what makes this a great business. The second, really study incentives. I have been amazed by how much I've learned over the last 15 years, just analyzing incentives of people. People ultimately are making decisions, and it's not just simple as like, oh, well, this stock's fallen 50% and it trades at a 10 times earnings multiple and this is the lowest. That's not the way to analyze a company. You want to analyze who is the person running the show? Like, what are his incentives? Who is mid-management? Do they speak up? You know, what is the culture? You really want to understand that. And I have a process where I've identified the best capital allocators in Asia, just looking at, you know, reading annual reports, just the clarity in communication. You want to admit mistakes, you know, Warren Buffett admits mistakes. Do these managers admit mistakes? Employees, mid-level employees, how are they incentivized? So really analyze incentives. And I think that is a very, you know, Charlie Munger says, pay attention to incentives. I think it's extremely important. And finally, this is the hard part. I think probably the hardest part, which most successful investors, you know, for a period of time, I think, you know, get relaxed about, is really make sure that it is, you're not swinging every, you know, you're really finding a great business at a great price. And a great price, when you find that and you know the business, you know, you just need to make a few great bets to have a successful investment career, and not act every day. You don't need to act, you know, most days. And so I think really the wonderful prize, and how do you define a wonderful prize? You know, I could go through it at some other conference, but really have a process around analyzing a company's cash flow in relation to its reinvestment opportunity, in relation to its return on capital, but its cost of capital as well, right? So if a company in India earns a return on capital of 15%, well, that's not that great because cost of capital is 10%, or 8, 10, 12%, right? So I'd rather invest in a Japanese company with a return on capital of 15, 20%, and cost of capital is almost zero, or one or two, right? So you have to be flexible. You have to understand how to understand what a wonderful price is in relation to that spread, right? And then the reinvestment opportunity is critical. And then, you know, avoid small caps. As I said, I've learned that during a crisis, they get the worst hit. And so that's what I would say, that those three things, John.
Well, great. We will leave it there, Sid. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today and to share your perspective on intelligent investing in Asia. I also look forward to having you with us quite soon at Asian Investing Summit 2020, where I understand you'll be sharing an idea or a couple ideas in depth. So looking forward to that. Sid, thank you. All the best to you.
Thank you very much, John.
Goodbye.
Stay safe. Bye.